This is Hitchhiking Off the Map.
Well, that didn't happen until sometime later, because, of course, when you're very young, you're reading the myths of your own culture, and absorbing them with zeal.
And when I scattered the ashes, they flew up in the sky for a moment and became iridescent.
There was this intense longing.
And so I was walking by the White House, looking at the White House.
Sometimes you have to go along for the ride. You have to go along with the ride.
It turned out to be a couple of miles, and it was mostly uphill through Chinatown.
I don't remember exactly when it turned on me, but I remember that by the age of 11 or 12, I was already proselytizing among my friends not to believe anything they were being taught about values.
You have to go along for the ride.
So it happened sometime between the age of 5 and 11. I don't know exactly when.
Hitchhiking Off the Map. This is Conrad Bishop, and you know, I've never actually hitchhiked. What am I doing a show about hitchhiking? I am an unqualified person here.
Well, as Elizabeth Fuller, I will answer you. You stand to make a lot of money. Most companies today select people who don't really know how to do what the company does to run them. Lack of experience is an important qualification.
Of course, that is a kind of one of those damn baseless exaggerations that just pegs us as mindless liberals. I mean, not to mention that we are coming to you from Sebastopol, California, under the redwood trees, and that's kind of suspicious in itself.
Well, the show is about journeys, and it's pretty hard not to seem a bit suspicious when you're in unknown territory.
Yeah, we have friends in Beverly Hills, and once we were visiting them, I made the mistake of going out for a walk in the neighborhood. Police car pulls up.
Ooh.
What are you doing here? So am I going to sound sarcastic if I say I'm walking? It just isn't done.
First story, which I guess is about exploring a territory. Discovery. Leon Katz.
Leon Katz is in his 80s. He's taught literature at leading universities, he's written many plays, he's mesmerized generations of students, myself included. He's had a well-traveled life, but he talks very little about himself. His deepest journeys have been into literature.
I trusted it. I trusted it as I trusted nothing else. I trusted the truth of the journey recorded in literature as I trusted nothing else, because it is possible with a book in front of you to become an observer equal in strength at the moment to the text of the book itself. Whereas in life, you cannot do exactly the same thing. You can be overwhelmed by the force and the power of an opponent. And when you're reading a book, you're under none of those constraints. You see, you're free. You're really in a situation so that your mind can operate directly on the text and think, is this true? Is this not true? Is this for me? Is it not for me? And so on. I remember reading in a lovely book called The Faith of Our Fathers about Jewish immigrants coming to this country. He describes a mother, I don't know if this is his own mother, but a mother taking her child to the library and saying, all right, now you have a library card, now read. It struck me because that's exactly the experience I went through at the age of 5. When my mother took me to the library, I read haltingly the words that made it possible for me to get the library card, and then she said, now you have a library card, now read. And that was open sesame for me, as it was for my whole generation. And it was a wonderful, wonderful moment, and I remember that vividly. And I thought, oh, all this is mine. But most of my journeys have been toward disillusion rather than toward what we think of as positive. I think disillusion is positive myself. But I found that, for example, on the question of religion, I got over that at the age of 7. I was in Hebrew school. And I remember that we got to Moses and the burning bush. And one of my colleagues, one of my confreres, raised his hand and asked the rabbi teacher, is this a true story? And he said, well, it's a myth. He said, well, but is that true? He said, well, it's a myth. I thought to myself, oh, it's a myth. And that cleared the question for me forever. It's a myth that's fascinating, and I continue to love the story of the Jewish people, how they came out of Egypt and all that sort of thing. And it delighted me no end, but it never occurred to me again that there was any truth in it whatsoever. Ever again. And there's a Spanish word for it that I use when I'm teaching Spanish literature. Desengaño. Desengaño. Unillusion. Not disillusion, but unillusion. The scales falling from your eyes when you suddenly see the plain truth. It seems to me that those are the journeys that are most impressive to me, the journeys that are desengaño. And the greatest of them all, I think, is King Lear. The discovery that King Lear makes at the end of his incredible journey, through terrible disappointment, through terrible disillusion, through terrible madness, and finally a clarification comes at the end, and that clarification is what the world is really made of. And the world is made of anything but the kinds of mythical beliefs that he was filled with at the beginning of the play. It's a horrible image. It's a horrible image of the world. And then desengaño takes on the meaning of disillusion, not just unillusion. The scales fall away from the eyes, to be sure, but then what is left is desperate. And Lear's conclusion, therefore, is get out of it. Leave it all together. We'll stay, he says to his daughter Cordelia, like birds in a gilded cage, watching who's in, who's out, taking upon us the mystery of things, out of the political world, out of the real world altogether, just watching. And of course, Shakespeare adds the ultimate coup de grace when that possibility is removed from him and he has none left at all.
What always struck me about Leon's lectures were, yes, he spoke about styles of literature, but not as a game. These were journeys into the principle of being human.
I love the mission of teaching. I really love it. And that's been true from the very day I started teaching. I thought, my God, what an opportunity this is to do good. And I'm still teaching. I tell you what I love to do with literature. I love to get into the spirit of a work as though I have written it myself. One of the plays I absolutely adore is Claude Dell's Satin Slipper. I did a production of it, I did a version of it, and so on. But it's a very, very great play. Claude Dell was the most reactionary Catholic the world has ever known. A bitter and a cruel man in every way, ideologically. But he's written this extremely great play, and it's written right out of his own ideology. But it is the idealism of his ideology. It is the pure beauty, the vein of gold within his ideology that he's writing in this play. If I teach that, that's what I'm teaching. I'm not teaching this reactionary. I hope to avoid that in anything that I do. It is not a question of finding the ideal critical posture, and certainly not the ideal political posture from which to teach. The whole point of teaching is that you want a student to become a citizen of the world, not for the world to become simply an aspect of himself that he already is familiar with. So I love teaching de Sade for the same reason, because de Sade himself has a truth in him that is absolutely true, that is really there. It really is so. What he describes of his own sexual intents, his sexual motives, what he describes of his fictional characters and motives and so on, is something that is deep in humanity. So I don't teach it as though this reprehensible human being is this. I teach it as though it is true, you see. And then the counter to that is in everything else that I'm teaching, you see, if you need a counter to that. I don't myself. I think that the Sade is it's quite accurate. Teaching is opening doors, not shutting them. You see? that is, of course, the purpose. There were many books, obviously, that had enormous effect on me. I remember going through Victor Hugo and that being the beginning of a romantic, sentimental feeling about the oppression and injustice and so on, and that I've never lost. I mean, you keep that forever. And that's the thing that if you lose that, then you're not even cynical. You're a nonentity. To see things as they are and to see things as they might be, as they ought to be, is something that you can do simultaneously. And you had better. Without one or the other, I think you're in deep trouble. There's a wonderful anecdote that Shaw tells. He said, once I was sitting in the circus, and there was a woman sitting beside me, who, when we were watching the lion tamer, she said, oh, the courage of that man is unbelievable. And Shaw turned to her and said, madam, that man is not exhibiting courage. What he is exhibiting is the certainty that the lions, who are well-fed, will not hurt him in any way. Consider, on the other hand, my own position sitting here, outside that cage, who am subject to every whim of politics, of religion, and any one of which could come and destroy me at this very moment. Madam, I am the man with courage. I thought that's extraordinarily wise, because he's exactly right. He's exactly right. When you're dealing with a world that, in which you are surrounded by multiple beliefs, every one of which is pushed to its absolute extreme of certainty, you're in real danger, as we now know. As we now know only too well. However, the reaction to it is not the reaction that I'm suggesting. It's the opposite reaction. Just as the attack on your values comes from a perspective of the absolute, your response to that attack becomes absolute as well. And it's just as evil. There is no difference between the evil of one and the evil of the other. None at all, as a matter of fact. Depending on the power that you have, your virtue can be a great deal more evil.
In the present-day rhetoric of good versus evil, he spoke of Danton's Death, a play written 20-odd years after the French Revolution.
Danton has, before the play begins, he was also a bright revolutionary light at the beginning of the revolution, and then was, to say the least, displaced by Robespierre. Robespierre is, in effect, the Stalin of the French Revolution, clearly. So virtuous is this man that he is evil itself. He thinks of himself as the martyred Christ. And in his own mind, in his own context, he truly is. He's not a hypocrite or anything of that kind. He means it. He genuinely means it. And what Danton recognizes is the horrible consequence of that kind of virtue manifesting itself in political life. It could not be worse. That kind of thing brought to its absolute is evil. That virtue pushed to its extreme becomes one of the most evil things in the world. These are terrible, terrible conclusions, to be sure, but the reality of them comes to us so hideously in the 20th century. So hideously, when every single ideal that we have conceived certainly in the Western world, every single one of them has gone to seed. Every single revolution in the 19th and 20th century has ended in something worse, which is a horrible thing to think of. So what is left of all this is, I think, very much what existentialism had in mind. It's not so much that you're living in an absurd universe as you're living in a dreadfully dangerous universe. And under those circumstances, the only thing to do is never to lose that vision that you had in the first place of the ideal of what life could be, the virtue of what life could be, see? Never to lose that ideal and never to suppose for a moment that it's within your grasp. Well, when you consider that, as I have said to my students many times, the 20th century is the most savage century that Western civilization has known. Without question, the most savage of all. It has done more devastating, more terrible, and more horrible things to humanity than almost any other century. Because we have the two things that are necessary to do the most devastating things in the world. We have the technology, and we have the language to justify it. That's what I despise about ideologies, because they simply justify whatever the technology is capable of doing. And frankly, the only value that I really value is the value of human experience. That's it. It's the condition, human condition, the condition of human beings, their relative comfort, their relative safety, the relative availability of a cultivated life. That's what I think is valuable, and that's all that I think is valuable in history. The rest of it doesn't matter at all.
What about stories of transcendence, achievement, illumination? Where do these fit?
I think they're beautiful. I really do. I think they're absolutely beautiful, and I'm tremendously moved whenever we get to the top of Parnassus. I think they're magnificent, but I will never lose my love for that possibility. I don't think it's possible, but I never lose my love for that possibility. those are redemptive. They're the very things that give one the sense of being human, rather than just being a factor of greed in the world. So it's one thing to think of the Divine Comedy, one thing to think of Milton, one thing to think of Walt Whitman, but every single one of them, their epiphanies are so grounded in the source and the beginning of that journey into the reality, in absolute reality, that you think of that becomes the most admirable kind of shoring up against the ruins, rather than being the sentimental notion that this is reality itself. And the myth that is perpetrated endlessly is the sentimental journey patterns that are used in contemporary literature. So you follow a character who goes through a journey till he reaches a kind of epiphany, and to think of that as a myth is one thing. To think of it as the reality of a life pattern is a cruel and terrible thing. And most of the American myths are precisely of that kind. You're hit with them from the day you're born, practically. And they're internalized to a degree where you really think that you're sharing in the American dream. And I think that those are absurd illusions and dangerous illusions. I think they're extremely dangerous, as a matter of fact.
When Leon speaks of these things, the subject is horror and the horribly ironic, but there's an energy, almost a delight. How does one speak of hopeless darkness with glee?
There's a glee in what I think of as the truth. There's a glee in facing it, in understanding it, in seeing it for what it is. I very strongly believe that this does not lead to desperation, and it does not lead to ultimate cynicism, because I think that cynicism itself is simply the emotional response to idealism. It's an idealism that you cannot realize, that you do not see realized, but it's one that you never lose.
In Los Angeles, we were talking with Leon Katz.
Yeah, we've known Leon for many years, from when I did graduate work at Stanford, and then periodically encountering him at one of the 14 universities he's taught at. He told me about his first teaching job at Vassar, being there 9 years, and then leaving and realizing, good Lord, I've become provincial. I'm becoming all those things I've been so satirical about. And he resolved to never allow that to happen again. And he has kept moving. And he's a very courtly gentleman. He looks a bit like a cross between Moses and Satan. And I was thinking, though, how can you be so violently absolute in condemning ideologies? What about good ideologies, like my ideology? And indeed, he has his own passionate, very vehement ideas about politics, etc. But he always has the capacity, with a work of literature, to engage in an extremely unfiltered, naked way. It's very fertile.
Fertility, yes. The starting point, being grounded in the absolutely real. A couple of years ago, we performed at a Unitarian church in Arcata, California. And after the show, a woman came to me and said, I want to tell you a story, and I'd trust you to use it if you'd like to. And so we did.
This is Ashes.
So, this is the way it went. She was expecting their first child. It was a difficult and fragile pregnancy. And for most of it, she had to stay in bed at home.
How do you feel?
Better today, I think.
Want some tea?
No, thanks.
During that span, the swallows came back to build their nests in the chimney. She felt a great kinship, hearing their own preparations for their progeny as she felt her son kicking inside her.
Lots of activity there.
You feel it?
Yeah.
Love you.
But
Her son lived only 4 days. She had to decide whether to remove life support. She knew he would never see or speak or walk or know himself. And her husband said, "You decide."
Look, there's no way I can say, let's be rational about this. I'm sorry to put the whole burden on you. I will support any decision, but he's been with you in your body, and so you're the one to say.
She asked that he be allowed to die. She'd had surgery, so back at home she was still in bed, and now she could hear the swallows attending to their young. She couldn't read or watch TV. She could only listen to their voices. She was still in bed when the young ones flew, and the parent birds left the nest. But one of the young did not leave. It fell into the dark space between the metal liner and the brick of the fireplace. And she could hear it bumping and floundering, unable to struggle free. Finally, her husband said, "You want me to do something about that?"
Should I try to take care of you or something? I don't know if I can, you know. Can I give it a try?
I don't know.
And she had to say yes. He wasn't sure he could do it. The liner weighed 300 pounds. But he did it, destroying the hearth in the process.
It's back there.
She reached in, past the ashes, and scooped up the young bird. She took it outside. She placed it on a low tree branch where it might be safe until it recovered enough to fly. But next morning, it was still clinging to the branch. She stood and watched. The sun came out and touched the bird, and in a while, it ruffled its wings, and then it flew. And she felt in that moment, in the morning sun, that she had done the right thing in allowing her son to die. He too had been trapped with no exit, and she had set him free. Soon after, she was in a coffee shop and struck up a conversation with a woman.
"Excuse me, is that your newspaper?"
"Oh, no, be my guest."
Who asked her, she still hadn't regained her figure, who asked her,
"So when are you due?"
When she was due. And she told her what had happened. And the stranger told her that she too had lost a child. Her child had drowned, had wandered off at a picnic to wade in the river. And the stranger said she was drawn to talk with pregnant women because she needed to be pregnant again. And they talked. And I thought, it must be harder to lose a child you had memories of, a child you could hear saying, "Mama." Now I have a daughter. It was a bedfast pregnancy again, but my daughter lived. I've regained my shape, mostly. My daughter's 3 now, and she really gives me a workout. I keep Joseph's ashes in a small sealed box. Very beautiful oriental box. And I don't actually think of him much. Except when I'm gardening. Or I'm lying in bed listening to the swallows. The swallows are in the chimney. So we don't use the fireplace now.
You are listening to Ashes with Elizabeth Fuller. And thanks to our friend in Arcata, California, for sharing her story, and to our next-door neighbor, Meg, for the coffee shop woman.
We'd like to invite you to share your stories, whether serious or silly, things that have stuck in your memory. Email us through our website, www.independenteye.org, where you can also listen to all of our past shows or purchase CDs for your own listening or give them as gifts to your friends.
Hitchhiking Off the Map is a production of The Independent Eye, with funding from the National Endowment for the Arts and the Hitchhikers Guild.
Next show, a Scots woman looks back on her nightmarish journey to Morocco, and a true tale of a couple's momentous meeting with the help of a forklift.
And we're wishing you peace and joy.
I have very, very good friends who are extremely committed politically. And when I hear them seeing everything through those spectacles alone, I allow them that. I allow them that. I think it's parochial. I think it's narrow. But it's necessary. To quarrel with every one of these at my age is an absurdity. To take a stance against every one of these postures is an absurdity. But I'm not exactly vegetating either.